I just want to take a moment to thank my co-authors on this, Nancy Biermeyer, Janet Noodleman, and Dr. Shirima Rasanayagam, who's in the audience today, and I have nothing to disclose. So I did my dissertation work on breast cancer and the environment, and I'm thrilled to be here as a social scientist, but also on behalf of a nonprofit. As you might imagine, given that my dissertation research was on this issue, I was absolutely thrilled to find a job at the single national nonprofit that does the same work that I was working on, the Breast Cancer Fund. We focus on market-based and policy changes that would reduce those exposures with the greatest evidence linking them to breast cancer, and in the hopes that those changes would facilitate prevention. Globally, breast cancer affects more women than any other type of cancer, and is the leading cause of cancer-related deaths among women. There are many widely understood risk factors for breast cancer, including primary genetic mutations, reproductive history, and lifestyle factors, such as weight gain, alcohol consumption, and lack of physical exercise. However, in total, these factors only account for a small portion of the risk of the disease, about 40 to 50%. And a substantial and growing body of evidence indicates that exposures to common chemicals and radiation, singly and in combination, also contribute to the unacceptably high incidence of breast cancer. Now, while our focus is on breast cancer, much of what I'm going to talk about today is relevant to other environmental health concerns as well, like learning differences, metabolic disorder, other cancers, etc. So that's an important disclaimer we always like to make. As we begin to think about the relationship between breast cancer and the environment, it is important to recognize that there are many different forms of the disease that have different prognoses, affect different populations differently, and that women in different groups are differently vulnerable to being diagnosed with the disease. So as this table shows, incidence of breast cancer is highest among white women, but this next table demonstrates that mortality is actually highest among African American women, and that the levels have declined for both groups, as they have for all population groups in the United States, but they've declined less quickly for black women than for white women. So understanding the racial and ethnic variations in susceptibility to risk factors for breast cancer is further complicated by other factors, such as the neighborhood where people live, where they grew up, the exposures that they might encounter in those neighborhoods or from occupational sources. So we can't just look by racial and ethnic groups. We have to take into consideration all those factors that correlate with that as well. Looking at Latinas, we can see that they are often diagnosed at later stages, at a regional stage where there's a bit of spread of cancer, than at localized stages where white women are mostly diagnosed at that localized stage. Now, it's important that as we think about Latinas, we know that most of the research on Latinas is in Mexican-American women, and that the statistics don't always take into account women from other nations of origin. But it's also notable that both African-American women and Latinas tend to be diagnosed at younger ages, and with the triple negative form of the disease, which is the more aggressive form, more often than white women or other population groups. So there is a disparity there that's not well explained by necessarily genetics or environmental factors at this point and deserves more exploration. As we consider how to address these sobering statistics, a public health orientation can help. This can support the prevention of disease, the promotion of health, and the assumption that societal factors shape patterns of health and illness. A focus on breast cancer and the environment supports these public health tenets. Environmental factors for risk factor for breast cancer have the biggest promise for prevention, because it's much easier to change the environment than it is to necessarily change genetics. So there's a tremendous opportunity there. In addition, primary prevention is a worthy goal given the huge burden of breast cancer and the challenges that burden brings to life, livelihood, and well-being. The arduousness of treatments, worries about recurrence, and the possibility of mortality of breast cancer are better solved through prevention than through treatment and early detection. Finally, successful prevention requires systemic changes that reduce exposures to toxic chemicals and unnecessary radiation, that reduce disparities in these exposures, and that create more equal access to healthy foods that are nutritious and free from toxic chemicals like bisphenol A, and that create more safe spaces for play and physical activity, and allow for occupational settings and communities that are unburdened by toxics. So as we begin to look at the evidence linking breast cancer and the environment, the Breast Cancer Fund's followed this evidence for about 10 years. And we've created a document called The State of the Evidence that has reviewed the peer-reviewed literature and covers a wider range of exposures and themes linked to this topic. It also covers policy and advocacy changes. So I'll talk about that more later. In the decade that we've followed the science, we've seen a tremendous growth in the pace, quality, and breadth of the research exploring these links between breast cancer and the environment. The methods have become more sophisticated, and that's important because we can't, in the way that we could with treatment, randomize people to one treatment and then another. We can't assign people randomly to what is presumed to be a harmful exposure. So we have to draw from animal studies, in vitro studies, and epidemiological studies to understand this and know how to reach actions that promote public health. The broad scientific literature exploring the relationships between exposures to environmental toxicants, including endocrine-disrupting compounds that either mimic or disrupt the body's own hormones, and development of breast cancer suggests four notable themes that should be considered proactively in the research agenda, risk assessment process, and chemicals management policies. So first, timing of exposures. Life stages such as prenatal development, puberty, and pregnancy, when the mammary gland is undergoing significant growth and reorganization, are critical periods of development which are especially susceptible to the effects of chemical exposures. Likewise, low doses matter. The effects of those endocrine-disrupting compounds that I briefly mentioned a moment ago, like bisphenol A and phthalates, don't necessarily follow a linear dose response curve. So low doses of those compounds, which have been found commonly in people's bodies, may affect later life risk of developing breast cancer when those exposures occur at the critical times that I talked about before. So this picture illustrates some of those times when hormones are acting upon a person's body to promote, you know, really dramatic external changes in the breast. And those times when those changes are happening are orchestrated by hormones that can be easily disrupted from exogenous hormones that come from the things we eat, the things we put on our bodies, and the environment at large. In addition, mixtures matter. We're all exposed to multiple chemicals every day through the air we breathe, the food we consume, the places where we work, play, and live, and the substances we put on our bodies. And research indicates that while some exposures act additively, where 1 + 1 = 2, some might add up synergistically to where 1 + 1 = 5 to affect health. We know that some communities experience inherently higher burdens of chemical exposures due to proximity to industry, agriculture, or hazardous waste sites, and that these communities are often facing poverty, isolation, and lack of opportunity. This means that chemical exposures will likely be combined with greater social stress, fewer opportunities, and infrastructure that is less likely to support a healthy diet, physical activity, and safer consumer purchasing choices. So this emerging research on mixtures suggests that the combination of these exposures may be greater than any one of these exposures alone. Finally, while mixtures of different exposures matter, those mixtures also interact with the features of our own being, such as our diet, our genetic profiles, our reproductive history, and other social factors. And some recent research illustrates this really in a compelling manner. So women with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations, which are mutations that confer dramatically higher risk, estimated to be between 40 and 85%, of women with BRCA will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lives, also may make those same women more susceptible to the adverse effects of radiation, especially earlier in life. Women with BRCA mutations are often encouraged to begin a variety of screening methods quite early in life, in their late teens, early 20s, including but not limited to mammography. Well, mammography is a radiation-based screening method. So if these women are more susceptible to radiation because of their genetic predisposition to breast cancer and asked to get more screening that is based in radiation, it clearly underscores the need for new imaging techniques to help detect their potential breast cancers early in life. And those methods need to be validated. They are often getting MRIs, but they're getting mammography too at this point, in the United States at least. So these themes suggest some different solutions when we're testing chemicals and radiation for their health effects. First of all, if timing matters, we have to test the effects of chemicals and radiation at those times when the individual may be most vulnerable. In the prenatal period, during puberty, and during pregnancy and lactation. Often that's not happening, especially prenatal and especially early life exposures. If low doses matter, we have to test those low doses. And that has not been the norm in toxicity testing. Instead, it's often been an extrapolation down from higher doses that are tested with the assumption of a straight line, which is not always the case. If mixtures matter, we have to test mixtures. And that means we have to coordinate exposure assessment and testing across the agencies that are monitoring and regulating these exposures. And finally, if interactions matter, we have to test those interactions as interactions, not as covariates, not as things to control for, but as interactions themselves. So there are six prevention-based policy directions that we can take. First of all, we can reform the Toxic Substances Control Act. This law, which was passed in 1986, and I'll give you just a second to think about what you were doing in 1976, gave the EPA the authority to regulate industrial chemicals. But unfortunately, the law has failed to protect health. Of the 84,000 chemicals that are registered for use, 62,000 of those were grandfathered in when the law was passed, with no testing. The EPA has been able to require testing for just over 200 of those chemicals, and only 5 in total have been restricted. The regulatory bar for TSCA was set so high that in the 1980s they couldn't even restrict asbestos. And in fact, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, were the only class of chemicals fully banned under TSCA. And that was done when the law was actually passed. So nothing has happened in so far as a ban since the passage of the law. There's been a lot of work to make changes to reform TSCA, and NGOs, the EPA, state health officers, and even the chemical and manufacturing industries agree that TSCA needs reform. However, the challenges lie in getting those groups to agree on what those changes need to be. The Safe Chemicals Act, introduced by Senator Lautenberg, would greatly strengthen our chemical management system. And in the Congress that is almost over, the bill got off out of committee but did not make a floor vote. We expect it'll be reintroduced in the next Congress. And the bill would allow for quick action on the worst chemicals, require safety data on all chemicals, and set a safety standard that protects the most vulnerable, including children, pregnant women, workers, and communities with disproportionate exposures. Now, other regulations also shape our chemicals picture in the United States. And you can see some of the different agencies and offices and the range of things that are regulated by those different agencies and offices in our country, leading to a very major fragmentation of regulation. And we can see, if we look at one example, cleaning products, that multiple agencies have jurisdiction over different elements of those products. So the CPSC regulates cleaning products, while the EPA regulates disinfectants used in those products. And OSHA and FDA regulate still more elements. So monitoring is another issue. And this needs to sample locations and populations that may have higher exposures. The NHANES is an excellent example of biomonitoring that uses state-of-the-art methods and does exceptional work, but it may not apply to all populations. For instance, we don't have data on the diverse population of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. It's reported for Mexican Americans, but not other groups of Latinos. And we have no data on Native Americans. So that needs to be expanded, but in the current financial climate, it might be cut. Finally, I have two more. Transparency. Policies need to allow for transparency, like ingredient disclosure for cleaning products, for fragrances that are in personal care products. And transparency also means that if we measure the amount of chemicals in a person's body, we report it back to them. Finally, we have to translate research into action. We can't have a lag of 17 years for 14% of the data to make it into public policies. We have to do better than that. And I just want to point to public engagement, which I don't have time to talk about, unfortunately, but we have to engage advocates in this work, and some resources, which you can talk to me about after the talk. Thank you very much.